So straight away, a little introduction to Alan. Alan is a distinguished British Labour Party politician, author and broadcaster. I hope you knew that already. Whose life is marked by resilience and achievement. Raised by his sister, Linda, in Battersea, London, he endured a difficult childhood marked by poverty and adversity, which he recounts in his celebrated and best-selling memoir, This Boy. He left school at 15, joined the post office as a postman at 18, and rose through the ranks of the Union of Communication Workers. In 1992, he became the youngest general secretary in the union's history, representing over 100,000 postal workers and gaining national prominence. His parliamentary career began with his election as MP for Kingston upon Hull West Hessel in 1997, a seat he held for 20 years. He quickly advanced through government ranks, serving as in succession of ministerial roles, Parliamentary Under-Secretary for Trade and Industry, Minister of State for Employment, and Minister of State for Higher Education. He joined Tony Blair's cabinet as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions in 2004, moving to Trade and Industry, Education and Skills, and Health in 2007. In 2009, he was appointed Home Secretary, serving until Labour left office in 2010. He later became Shadow Home Secretary and Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer. After leaving Parliament, Alan has become a celebrated memoirist, writing the Orwell Prize-winning book, This Boy, and has published several acclaimed sequels. In 2023, he was appointed Chancellor of Hull University, continuing his commitment to public service and education. His politics, and I'm going to define these in front of the man himself, I've got to be prepared to be thrown off the stage. His politics are defined as pragmatism, realism, combined with a commitment to fairness, social mobility, and democratic reform. I give you Alan Johnson.
Great. Thank you.
We've got a lot to get to. 45 minutes on a man of 20th century note. And talking of, I think, to start with 20th century note, why 20th century man?
Because Harold Wilson wasn't the first British Prime Minister born in the 20th century. John F. Kennedy was the first American president born in the 20th century. Wilson was only a year older than Kennedy and was often called the British Kennedy, by the way, back in the 60s. But he wasn't the first British Prime Minister born in the 20th century. That accolade belongs to his predecessor, the 14th Earl of Hume, who renounced his titles using legislation that Tony Benn, ironically, had pioneered to become Alec Douglas Hume. But I think it's fair to say that whereas the public felt that Wilson looked like a man of the modern age, that didn't particularly describe Alec Douglas Hume. You know, he often looked like an Edwardian. He was out on the grouse moor shooting grouse. And this is in an era where there's less deference, where, you know, the 60s has broken with all the cultural changes that brought along. And I think people felt that Wilson was a 20th century man. He was Elizabeth II's fifth prime minister, but the first to be educated at a state school, and certainly the first who you could hear a kind of accent from Northern England. He was a Yorkshireman, and that also meant he was something different and perhaps more in tune with the modern age.
It's interesting you say that Alec Douglas Hume looked Edwardian, had a social life Edwardian, whereas Harold Wilson was this modern man. Many people would see him in his Gannax raincoat with his pipe, perhaps being parodied by Mike Yarwood on the television. Yeah. Was he at the time perceived as the great modernizer, great man? great 20th century man.
Yes, and you know, in a sense, Alec Douglas Hume was a gift to him. So he was, when Gateskill died, Hugh Gateskill was the leader of the Labour Party, was, I think, foreseen as being the leader for some time. He was a fairly young man in political terms. Died of lupus, struck down in that young, terrible winter of 1963, died at 54. So when Wilson became leader, Harold Macmillan was still leader of the Conservative Party. Wilson was very much about modernism and about moving the country into the to what they used to call the jet age or the television age. And here was this gift with the 14th Earl of Hume. I mean, Alec Douglas Hume, a decent man, by the way, but he had to renounce not just one peerage, he had several of them, all from the nefarious activities of his ancestors in the Middle Ages. And there was one period he realized after a while that he couldn't run the country from the Lords. That had happened in Victorian times, but was probably not, you know, part of the 60s zeitgeist. And so he renounced his peerage. But then there was this strange situation where they had to find a seat for him. So for the first time in our long constitutional history, for 6 weeks, our Prime Minister was neither in the Lords or the Commons. And so that struck many people as being strange. The other thing was, ironically, Alec Douglas Hume was the only Prime Minister to have been a first-class cricketer. We should all be celebrating cricket at the moment because of England's great win over India. But Wilson very cleverly used the analogy of first-class cricket to identify Alec Douglas Hume and the kind of society that Britain was labouring under. So the MCC had only just ended the distinction between gentlemen and players. They only ended that in 1962. Wilson honed in on that, a great fan of cricket, by the way, as he would do, being a Yorkshireman. And he pointed out that we were a country run by gentlemen, where the players, i.e. the professionals, were kind of thought of as second class. And you have to understand that world of, well, you don't necessarily have to understand cricket, but that world where if you were a gentleman, you could captain England. If you were a player, i.e. a professional, Freddie Truman or whatever, you would never captain England. If you were a gentleman, you walked out onto Lords or the Oval through a different gate to the players. You dined in a different room. Your initials came before your surname, whereas if you were just a player, like a professional, your initials came after your surname. Great moment of Fred Titmuss walking out onto, he says in his memoirs, he was walking out onto the field at the Oval, I think it was, and there was an announcement that held everyone's attention. There's been an error in the program. F.J. Titmuss should be Titmuss F.J. He was a player, not a gentleman. I mean, you had to live through those times to kind of, but Wilson, as he so often did, used that as such a good analogy for where Britain was and how it was being hidebound by these old
values. I think that we'll come back to that later, that his ability, and he wrote his own speeches by and large, didn't he?
Well, he wrote The White Heat of Technology himself.
He understood that bon mot, just two or three lines would be the thing that would advertise whatever he was talking about in perhaps a long speech. But we'll come back to those because there are some extraordinary moments in the speeches early on and indeed through his premiership, many premierships. Why don't we go back a little and talk a little about his childhood and his upbringing, because that's really important in what we talk about later.
Yes, so he was born lower middle class family. His father, Herbert, was an industrial chemist, had a lasting bee in his bonnet that he'd never gone to university. He stayed in education later than most people did in those times, until he was 18, but he'd become an industrial chemist, always wanted to go to university, never managed it. He had this determination that both his children, Wilson, Harold had a sister, Marjorie, who was 7 years older than him, that they would both go to university. And that was something that he cared about very deeply. And he succeeded. Marjorie went to Leeds University, very unusual for a woman. Harold eventually went to Oxford. But it was difficult. Harold's big political turning point, I think, because the household was basically liberal. Herbert was a big fan of Gladstone. There was a big portrait of Gladstone in the front room. And this was a time in British politics where those who didn't want to vote Conservative or Unionists, as they were then, would generally vote for the Liberals. But gradually from 1900 on, the Liberals were sinking and Labour was rising. Same thing might be happening at the moment on the right of British politics, who knows? But back then, it wasn't unusual for a family who voted Liberal to gradually turn to Labour. And that was what was happening in the Wilson household. But they soon realized they had two fiercely bright children.
Harold was very bright.
Harold, if there is such a thing as a photographic memory, and I'm not sure there is, but if there is, he had one.
What was his party trick down the pub was multiplying
That was Herbert, yeah. Herbert. His dad had this trick. Any seven numbers multiplied by any other seven numbers, and he'd do it within 50 seconds. And there's a story in the book about how he does that, actually on the day that Harold meets Mary, his future wife, but that's another story. But the defining moment for Harold is Herbert lost his job. In the scourge of they were in Huddersfield, in the scourge of unemployment in the 30s, eventually it claimed Huddersfield, and he lost his job as an industrial chemist, was unemployed for 18 months, got a job again, but it was on the Wirral. It was Port Sunlight. It meant a move of house, which meant that Harold, in his last year, in that crucial year that he was taking what we would now call A-levels, had to move to a completely new school on the Wirral, on Merseyside. So that disrupted his education, as did the fact he got typhoid. He drank a glass of milk that was unpasteurized, no penicillin in those days, as so often, 12 people drank the milk that this farmer was giving away. Harold was at a scout camp. He and another scout had a glass of milk. Harold accidentally knocked his mate's glass out of his hand. Lucky friend. Harold drank his. 12 people got typhoid. 6 died. Wilson was in hospital for 6 months. So lost all that from his education as well. So that, plus having to move school at that crucial year, should have set him back. But he was so fiercely bright, his father was so determined, that in the end, he got to go to Jesus College, Oxford.
Which originally was to study modern history?
Well, this is a good story about Harold and about how bright he was. I mean, he ended up being the student of his generation. But he went to Oxford to study modern history. He did his first term, and then at Christmas, just before the Christmas holidays, he went to his lecturer, to his tutor, and said, "I want to change to modern greats." Modern greats was what they then called the famous politics, philosophy, and economics, PPE. It was a very new course at Oxford. It only started in 1926. This is the 30s. And his tutor said, "If you want to swap, you need a second language." He already had French. He was very good at Esperanto, by the way, but that didn't count. You already had French. And his tutor said, "You have to learn German." Now, why you would need German for PPE or modern greats? He was, I think, setting Harold up to fail. Harold goes home with a Teach Yourself German book under his arm and spends the 6-week Christmas holiday learning German, comes back and passes the equivalent of an A-level. So if it was setting up to fail, it failed. He swapped on to modern greats. But that's indicative. And then he goes on. He's the first ever student at Oxford to win an Alpha Plus for economic theory. Along the way, he picks up these glittering prizes. The Gladstone Prize, now and then, you know, the great prize you could win as a student. He had to write an essay of 15,000 words with 500 footnotes on the history of the British railways. And he did that, won the Gladstone Prize, big event in the Bodleian Library, brings his mum and dad along and all that. He not only wins that, he wins the Webb Medley Scholarship, which is another fearsomely contested prize. He wins that, which gives him an extra 2 years as a kind of postgraduate and makes him a don, age 21. So you can understand why in 1938, when William Beveridge comes back to Oxford, having spent 14 years setting up the London School of Economics. This is well before the famous Beveridge Report. That doesn't come till 1942. But he wants to study the causes of unemployment in modern societies and why it was such a scourge of the 30s. And he says to, you know, sitting at high table, he says to the fellow dons, etc., do you know of a bright young student who's good at statistics? Well, of course, Harold Wilson. So Wilson goes immediately, he's a don, age 21, but then he goes to work with a man whose name is still synonymous with the huge changes post-war, William Beveridge.
What his talent was amongst many, and you talk about the awards, but I'm led to believe that he still holds the highest mark in economics to this day that was ever got in a TRIPOS exam.
Economic theory, yeah.
Economic theory, which is extraordinary to this day.
I think it is to this day. Certainly, they've never seen his like at Jesus College.
He was taken on because he had this ability to be able to... he was a statistician, he was he liked the analysis. He could bring in information and order it quite quickly into things that people could make decisions and sense of.
Yes. He had an ability to explain these things as well, but he was also excited by statistics. He became eventually the president of the Royal Society of Statisticians. He used to recite it to himself to check if he'd had too much to drink. You try it, the Royal Society of Statisticians. It seems I'm okay. You know, he found real enjoyment in that. But then he goes off, and this is the thing I didn't know about Wilson. I can see there's a few baby boomers here like me. And unlike Tom Holland, who I've just listened to in that marvelous lecture, I mean, not many people will remember his subject. Not many of you were around at that time. But with Wilson, many of you will remember Harold Wilson and have memories of him. But, I knew a lot about him. I didn't know about what a brilliant student he was. I didn't know he worked for Beveridge. He then went on to work for Jean Monnet. Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman, the Frenchman with a German name, established the European Coal and Steel Community after the war that became the European Union. Wilson worked for Jean Monnet. The joke amongst Eurosceptics is Monnet is the root of all evil. Passes as a joke. He went to work at New College for a great academic called G.D.H. Cole. And G.D.H. Cole was a Fabian socialist, a gradualist. And I think it was Cole that really made Harold a Labour man rather than a Liberal man. Can I just tell you an anecdote about G.D.H. Cole? Because I think it's brilliant. Nothing to do with the book. It's not in the book. But there was an academic at Oxford who died, and I wish I could remember his name. I read the obituaries, and this was about 20 years ago. And the great story about this academic is he had to show Margaret Thatcher around her old college, which I think was New College. And they stopped under a portrait of G.D.H. Cole. And this academic, this was the early 80s, this academic deliberately said, oh, this is G.D.H. Dole, knowing he'd be corrected. And sure enough, Margaret Thatcher said, Cole, not Dole, which was the motto, the motto of the National Union of Mine Workers in the middle of the miners' strike. I mean... I think that man deserved his obituary.
I think we should wind this up now and just go. That's the end. So he starts to embed himself within the Labour institutions, if you like. I want to prompt you to go to timber and Russia.
Yeah. Well, he is so successful. He's successful as a civil servant, accessing timber. Because he met a guy called Tom Meyer, and Montagu Myers was the biggest British timber company did a lot of trade around the world. And when Harold was a civil servant in the war, he's perfectly willing to fight. He wasn't a pacifist. But they decided that his brain needed to be used on energy as well, on coal. He virtually wrote the blueprint for the nationalization of the coal industry. This is why he's a civil servant. He's so good at all this stuff, and he knows his stuff about timber, that when he does get into Parliament in the 45 general election, in that landslide, Attlee promotes him very quickly. In fact, he promoted him before his backside touched the green benches. It happened to a couple of Labour MPs last summer.
He was never a backbencher. Never
a backbencher until the mid-50s. He was plunged straight into being a minister. And then very quickly, Attlee, who I think was more of his mentor, people say that Nye Bevan was Wilson's mentor, but I think Attlee fits that description. Ernest Bevin, the foreign secretary, you've got to get your Bevins and your Bevans right on this. Ernest Bevin was negotiating with the Russians for a trade deal. Remember, the Russians are our allies. It's 1945, 46. We wanted to do the first trade deal ever with Russia. Bevin is very ill. Attlee decides to send Wilson out, who's very junior. He's a junior minister in the Department for Works. And he goes out and virtually has to take over from this great figure, Ernest Bevin. And he's up against a guy called Anatoly Moikin, a Russian who actually lasted from Lenin to Brezhnev. I mean, how he ever escaped Stalin on the way, I don't know. But he was long in the tooth already in the 1940s. And he must have thought, this is a tasty little morsel I'm being served here to negotiate with this fresh-faced 27-year-old on timber and all the other stuff. But Wilson knew his stuff. He knew all about it. He didn't manage to get a trade deal for reasons that I explain in the book, but he earned the respect of Mikoyan. He earned the respect of the British Civil Service. He earned the respect of the Foreign Office. And most importantly, he earned huge respect from Attlee for the way he'd conducted himself. That was incidentally when he started to smoke a pipe. He used to chain smoke cigarettes, but he realized that smoking a pipe was a useful negotiating tool. You know, if they made an offer to you, you could fill your pipe and go for all the paraphernalia of the tobacco pouch and then lighting it and relight, and all the time you use it for thinking time. And so he began to smoke a pipe, and he certainly began, Attlee was then beginning to think, this man is cabinet material.
But this is the moment, where he was in Moscow, he was negotiating these things he had good relationship with the Russian negotiators. Yeah. And this was the moment that the English-British Secret Service started to look over the fence and said, perhaps a little too friendly?
Yes. I mean, as Home Secretary, I was responsible for MI5, but in these days,
stop. Tell us.
Yeah, we're not at Cheltenham. We're at Cheltenham, where GCHQ is. I always worry about the audience, but here, we're fine. You've got to remember, there was no monitoring of our security services, either MI5 or MI6, until Mrs. Thatcher introduced it in the 80s.
Well, a spy catcher.
They were complete. Well, spy catcher Peter Wright. Yeah, all of that. So they were virtually, you know, rogue males out there. They opened a file on Wilson. And this is perhaps, if you remember something about Wilson, you might remember him being paranoid about the security services, which he probably was. I tell you, he had a lot to be paranoid about. MI5 opened a file on him in 1945 under the code name Norman John Worthington. Really because he'd spoken to some Russians and he seemed to get on with Mikoyan. And that immediately, in those days, set MI5 thinking this is a, you know, someone who might be persuaded to be a double agent or to be an agent for the Russians. So that was the start of that. Of course, there's no one who was less likely to go across to the Russians than Wilson, but it was something that dogged him throughout his career.
It really was. You know, it was newspaper fodder when he was in Parliament and after Parliament, but also, you know, there was this all the time. If he would go to Russia or talk to them, it added to this conspiracy that was being fermented under the security services.
Yes, and for Wilson, who is particularly worried about this because he knew some of the things that were going on. You know, the head of MI6, Roger Hollis, had been under investigation, suspected of being a double agent, for 5 years while Wilson was prime minister, and nobody told him. He found out about it in the 70s and was naturally very concerned that he hadn't been informed about that. So all these things were going on. You know, when it came to the 70s, when he came back in, this is a man who won 4 elections, by the way, only matched by Gladstone in the 19th century, won a European referendum, not matched by Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton in 2016. So amazingly successful politically. But when he came back in the 70s, you know, a lot of things were going on. For a start, he'd refused to send a single British soldier to Vietnam and seriously upset the Americans. And he knew that if the CIA was looking to dig dirt on him, you know, they had cause to do it. He knew about Jeremy Thorpe, you know, that Boss, the South African Secret Service, killed Norman Scott's dog, Norman Scott having been Jeremy Thorpe's lover. They were supposed to shoot Norman Scott. It's been subject of a great drama a couple of years ago. Wilson knew all about that. Thorpe told him all about that. He knew what was going on there. And he also knew, you know, that there was not just a KGB around, but our own security forces. Peter Wright, you spoke about Spycatcher. Peter Wright said there was a strong suspicion. Peter Wright, having been in MI5 and then done, you know, the thing that nobody does, including ex-Home Secretaries, reveal what they knew. And he said that the theory in MI5 was that the KGB had killed Gaitskill. Gaitskill died of lupus. They'd killed Gaitskill so that Wilson could take over and be... I mean, this is, when you read someone like Peter Wright saying that, who wasn't the best witness, by the way, well, but had been there, was a spy.
But Peter Wright was the person that, when asked, well, how many of you were involved in this, said, oh, at least 30.
Yeah.
And they said, well, can you name them? Well, perhaps one or two.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the tenor
came
of the whole bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But all added to Wilson's view. Apparently, when you went in his late, it's nothing to do with the dementia that eventually killed him. If you met Wilson in the gents' toilets in the House of Commons and you wanted to chat with him, he'd turn all the taps on so that there was water flowing and whoever was bugging him. So, and that really became, you know, the old joke was, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean the bastards aren't out to get you. And that was kind of Wilson's.
Well, let's roll back to late 50s, early 60s, because I think there's a lot happening there in terms of the premiership. Sadly, as you say, Gaitskill, Bevan dying, and votes that took place to become deputy PM and thence PM. Unravel that for us a little bit.
Yeah, well, through the 50s, Wilson eventually did sit on the back benches. He resigned with Nye Bevan in protest at Gaitskill's budget. Gaitskill was the Chancellor in 1951, applied a charge to teeth and glasses. So the NHS, free at the point of need, they'd already introduced a prescription charge of a shilling in 1949. Bevan hadn't resigned, Nye Bevan, who was the Secretary of State for Health. After Attlee won the election narrowly in 1950, he moved Bevan to Labour, to the Ministry of Labour. Wilson became President of the Board of Trade at 31 years of age, the youngest cabinet minister since Lord Henry Petty in 1806. And people expected Bevan to resign. When Gaitskill said, we need to raise money, people were queuing up. You might remember your parents or grandparents. I mean, I certainly remember it. People wanted to have all their teeth out in working class communities because their diet was so poor that eventually they knew they'd have to have them all out and it would be a life of pain gradually having them removed. So they would go to the dentist once the NHS was established, free of charge, and say, take them all out. Give us a set of dentures.
But there was a reason, an extra reason, if you like, why they were against this raise in prescriptions.
Because Bevan resigned, as expected, because of the charge on teeth and glasses. Wilson wasn't expected to resign, but resigned with him, with one other junior minister, a guy called John Freeman. And actually, Wilson then was classified as a Bevanite on the left. There were about 36 Bevanites in the Parliamentary Labour Party. Bevan, this mercurial Welshman, this great orator, very different to Wilson. Wilson's speeches were described by an early parliamentary sketch writer as mountainous sandwiches of tedium, which must have done his confidence a lot of good. But when it came to their resignation speeches, which you're entitled to do from the back benches, Bevan's was terrible. It was, you know, spreading vitriol everywhere, slagging off the Tories, slagging off his own party, slagging off his own party leader. And he went down in a kind of blaze of glory and nobody took much notice of it. Even Bevan's biographer, Michael Foote, said it was a disaster. Wilson, the next day, made a very considered speech. May have still been a mountainous sandwich of tedium, but he put it into a different context. This wasn't all about the NHS being free of charge. There was nothing sentimental or emotional. He pointed out Gaitskill was imposing these charges because they needed to support America in their war effort in Korea. If you feel a few kind of reverberations to modern politics, you can be forgiven. And what Wilson said, because he knew all about supplies, he knew all about the metal that was available to build tanks, he knew about all of these things with his background at the Board of Trade as well. And his speech was, look, you're going to raise this money and you're not going to be able to spend it because most of the materials we need to increase our defense capability has been earmarked by the Americans. They've got it all. And there was a subsequent general election, Tories won. Churchill admitted the following December that Wilson and Bevan had been absolutely right, that money could not be spent on defense because they didn't have the materials
to spend. He was
So he was right. He was proved right.
Which is always good for your political position at that point.
Yeah. But it didn't do him any good to be classified as a Bevanite. No. He wasn't a Bevanite. Wilson always said he was a co-belligerent of Nye Bevan, not a satellite. And he was always a moderate, if you like, but was this dogged him, Nye's little dog, Hugh Dalton called him. And it took him a while to get over that. So then we go through the period when when Gaitskill dies. Wilson had just lost a vote to become deputy leader of the Labour Party. He lost it to George Brown, a man called George Brown. If you're around afterwards, I'll tell you some jokes about George Brown, but they're not apparent here.
Tired and emotional, Jen.
Yeah. Tired and emotional, where the term comes. But come the big one, you know, not the deputy leadership anymore, but the leadership, Wilson reversed and won. Mainly because James Callaghan came in as a third candidate. So only MPs elected the leader then. And Callaghan coming in as a third candidate split the vote and Wilson came through and beat Brown to become leader of the Labour Party.
Just so this is the same, just to perhaps shine a little bit of a light on Wilson's political position, because often we're talking about a sort of pragmatist and an ideologue or idealist. Just to quote you about, quote back yourself, isn't that terrible for me to quote something at you and justify it? This is Harold Wilson. His approach to the Labour Party was like his approach to religion, a believer but never devout, a man of considerable intellect but not an intellectual, a pragmatist rather than an idealist.
Absolutely, sums him up. And you see that again and again when you look at the dilemmas he faced. And also that he hated dogma. So when he was at Oxford, he refused to join the Labour Club because he said it was full of public school Marxists. And there was a lot of entryism that went on both at Oxford and Cambridge, communists in the 1930s. He couldn't stand that. And so he was the least likely Bevanite, but that was something he was
told. Well, you do then go on to say, quote Sir Raymond Street, who I know you probably enjoy. He is quick on the uptake, too well-versed in economics, a civil service work to rant or rave like a soapbox socialist. He lets his mind work on lines that come naturally to a young economist with civil service experience. We shall get on easily with him. Yeah. And then even better, I think, and we'll move on from here. This was in the Birmingham Gazette on a Balfour. A nice, quiet, plump and good-humoured fellow who had not yet quite got used to being the person of importance he now is. In repose, his manner is graying temple, and his formal clothes give him an appearance of middle age. But once he begins to speak, he cannot restrain his liveliness nor his interest in a subject or person. So he's growing.
He's growing, and he's also teaching himself, as he taught himself German to get on to modern greats. Nye Bevin said to him, a bit of advice to him, drop all the statistics from your speeches. You know, introduce some colour, introduce some humour. And he kind of taught himself public speaking by going out on the road. The Tribune magazine used to run a thing called the Brains Trust based on a home service radio programme. And he volunteered to go because it brought him in contact with an audience, which he'd never done. He'd never come through the ranks of the Labour Party. He'd never gone to boring general council meetings. He'd never gone out on the knocker.
Where you learnt your craft.
Never done any of that. And this helped him. And he was famous for his repartee and his wit and his great public speaking, but he taught himself to do it.
And at this point, or around this point, a certain individual of much influence came into his life, which, of course, we'd like to be introduced to.
Let's get on to the salacious stuff, shall we? On a very memorable date, the 23rd of April, 1956, 23456, Wilson goes to...
Year before I was born, exactly.
Is it? Right. Wilson goes to a meeting of the parliamentary... a dinner that the Parliamentary Labour Party were laying on, Shadow Cabinet were laying on, for Khrushchev, who was making his first visit as a Russian leader, the first ever Russian leader to visit Britain since the revolution. This is 1956. Transport House, Labour Party headquarters, send a young secretary to take notes. So important is this meeting. And she's a woman called Marcia Williams. She was Marcia Field, married a guy called Williams, who she met at university. He was an aerospace engineer. In about 1956, he went to Seattle to work in America and never came back. Now, Wilson then was shadow chancellor then. So he's there. There's some ambiguity about what happened. The rumor is he drove Marcia home. I'll tell you what Linda McDougall, who is Marcia Williams' biographer, says. So Harold has loads of biographers. I'm just the latest. Marcia only has one, published 2 years ago. And actually, I'm doing the Cheltenham Festival with Linda McDougall, who wrote the biography of Marcia Williams. And what Linda says is, did they have a physical relationship? It's difficult to believe that they didn't in the early days. And I just quote that in the book. I think it's the best way to put it. But it was long over by the time Wilson became prime minister. Now, you know, given in the British, legends of the bedroom who've been prime ministers, Wilson comes very low down. I mean, have you read Robert Harris's book about Asquith, Precipice? I mean, he was followed in, or Lloyd George came before him. Lloyd George took his mistress into 10 Downing Street. And that's before you get round to more recent prime ministers whose names I won't mention. But what we do know is Marcia was very important to Wilson's success. She was his political secretary.
She was a very clever politician.
A very clever woman.
Very bright, very intelligent.
The only person he consulted on the famous White Heat of Technology speech was Marcia. And she was with him till the end. But this, and when he became prime minister, by the way, she's his political secretary, the political secretary to the prime minister. He goes off to America to have his first meeting with Lyndon B. Johnson. The civil service said, Marcia can only go if she goes as Mary, Wilson's wife, hairdresser. And this was what politics was like.
And forgive us, this is the first time Mary has been mentioned.
Yeah.
But she, the
she's
two
a good
will
friend
be intertwined.
Of Marcia's as well. Right. But you know, there's jaw-dropping moments in this book. There are jaw-dropping moments about the relationship
not
between Harold and Marcia. I'm going to give you a... if you have jaws, prepare to drop them now. Here's jaw-dropping moment number one. This rumour about them having it away was doing the rounds. At the 64 election, when Wilson wins, scrapes home by four seats, during the election campaign, it's all about the Profumo scandal. I mean, Macmillan stepped down on the grounds of ill health. He became the second longest-lived prime minister in our history. He stepped down, really, because of the Profumo scandal. And hence, Alec Douglas Hume comes along. At the 64 election, Quentin Hogg, the very prominent conservative politician, is being barracked at a public meeting, rather like this, about Profumo and about John Profumo having been the Secretary of State for War, having to resign because of the affair he was having with Christine Keeler, who was also having an affair with the Russian attaché, defense attaché at the same time. So all of this stuff is coming out. Quentin Hogg defends himself by saying, if you think the only adulterers in the House of Commons are on our front bench, I suggest you look to Labour's front bench. Now, it was a clear reference to Marcia. And because of that, Attlee had to be dragged out. It was in the Lords to kind of say some things on the telly that night, and the thing blew over. But here's the jaw-dropping stuff. In 1967, so Wilson's been prime minister now for 3 years, a band called The Move record a record called Flowers in the Rain. They have a publicist who's a nut job called Tony Secunda. Actually, he's their manager, not just their publicist. The band's away touring Scandinavia. Unbeknown to them, Tony Secunda decides that the way to draw attention to this band called The Move and this record called Flowers in the Rain is to send a postcard to 500 top record executives. On the front of the postcard is a cartoon of a naked Harold Wilson and a naked Marcia Williams frolicking on a four-poster bed. It has nothing to do with the song Flowers in the Rain, by the way. Wilson sues. Jaw-dropping moment number one. It goes to court. The barrister defending the government, i.e. prosecuting, on behalf of Harold Wilson, is Quentin Hogg. The shadow Home Secretary, moonlighting as a barrister, winning the case, but he's the one who started all the stuff about Marcia and Harold in the first place. Jaw-dropping moment number two, for you great fans of rock music, as I am, one of the other things that Wilson had to deal with was the pirate radio station. So you'll remember, lots of you, you know, 15 million of us were listening to Radio London or Radio Caroline or the pirate radios who set up just outside British maritime waters so they couldn't be prosecuted, because it's the only way we could hear wall-to-wall pop music. Couldn't hear it from the dear old Beeb on the Light programme. Wilson outlawed the pirate radios. The BBC had to change tack, obviously. Away went Home Service, away went the Light programme. I sat there on the 27th September 1967. I was 17, just on my way Saturday morning to work at Tesco's in Hammersmith King Street, by the way, while I was trying to be a big pop star myself. But anyway, I was sat there with the old Steam Wireless place that family I was staying with at 7 a.m. when for the first time we would hear Radio London. Tony Blackburn, 7 a.m., first record he plays, Flowers in the Rain by The Move. The royalties of which, because Wilson won the case, went to, of the that record and its B-side, went to two charities determined by Marcia and Harold. And those charities got £250,000. They only stopped receiving it when Marcia died, which was about 5 years ago.
5 years ago, yeah.
So, you know, Quentin Hogg on the one hand and then Radio 1, you
couldn't
make it up.
Simply
no.
couldn't happen today, could it? Simply couldn't. Let's go back into politics as, and hopefully not as boring compared to that, but perhaps if we look at Harold Wilson when he becomes Prime Minister, there is this kind of duel that takes place over the next 15 years, 10, 12, 15 years, between Edward Heath and Harold Wilson, two people who were making the rain for each of their parties. Tell us a little about this.
The Heath-Wilson, yeah. I mean, they're unique because they're on a Beatles album, Revolver, Taxman, Taxman Mr. Wilson, Taxman Mr. Heath, very much part of that 60s. And Heath becomes the leader of the Conservative Party to succeed Alec Douglas-Hume. Wilson changed the Tory Party. Alec Douglas-Hume had not been elected by anyone, hadn't been elected by Tory Party MPs, never mind Conservative members. A group of chaps got together in convivial surroundings, and people waited for the smoke to go up the chimney, like a papal conclave. Who will be the next Prime Minister? They decided, despite the fact they had people like Reg Maudling, Ian MacLeod, you know, very, very prominent Conservatives, they decided on the 14th Earl of Hume. There wasn't another Old Etonian elected by the Conservatives until David Cameron. And that was how effectively Wilson attacked Hume and his privilege and all the rest of it. Dear old Alec Douglas Hume, when he, you know, for the umpteenth time, Wilson was calling him the 14th Earl of Hume. And Alec Douglas Hume in Parliament said, well, in a way, you're the 14th Mr. Wilson. You know. So, anyway, you know, what did you get then? You got Heath, the grammar school boy, followed by Thatcher, the grammar school girl, followed by Major, the grammar school boy, followed by the comprehensive lad from Rotherham, William Hague. And it wasn't until, and I think that was the effect. I don't think the two of them got on, but they certainly knew each other because Heath
was the antithesis of.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he was arrogant. He was self-possessed. He bulldozed people.
That was true, but they were both grammar school boys, and they both were affected, as all politicians were then, by the Second World War. You know, I mean, that generation were heroic. Many of them fought on, you know, and many of them saw active service and whatever you were doing. I mean, for Wilson, it was in the civil service. Heath was a diplomat, had been in Berlin as Hitler rose in power. All of those things, I think, gave them a kind of camaraderie that you wouldn't have now. So Heath was leader of the opposition. Wilson was prime minister. 1970, Heath wins, the only election Wilson was going to thought he was going to win. He was a Jeremiah when it came to elections, but he lost. So Heath is suddenly prime minister and Wilson is opposition. Heath didn't resign when he was beaten and Wilson didn't resign when he was beaten, which is very different to what happens now. And in 74, Wilson comes back again and wins, and then wins two elections in 74 against Heath. So they've been up against each other, as you rightly say, for almost 10 years. So they kind of knew each other's. But here's another interesting story and another jaw-dropping moment, by the way. You know, when Enoch Powell made that racist speech, Rivers of Blood, Heath sacked him immediately from the shadow cabinet. Come 74, arguably, Enoch Powell won the election for Wilson. And here's how it happened. Powell was leaving the Conservative Party to go over to the Ulster Unionists to Northern Ireland. He had met Wilson. He asked to meet Wilson. His big beef was that Heath had taken Britain into the European Economic Community as it was then, without any referendum, there was a vote in Parliament, but there wasn't a referendum. Wilson had promised a referendum. That was in the Labour Party manifesto. Powell wanted Labour to win. He hated Heath. And he hated the fact he'd taken him into Europe. Wilson arranges to meet him. This is not from Wilson's biographies. It's not from any Wilson biography. It's from Powell's biography. Wilson asked to meet him in the only place where them being seen together chatting would not draw any attention, the gentleman's lavatory of the I Lobby in the House of Commons in mid-afternoon. I've been in the gentleman's lavatory in the I Lobby. There's never anybody in there until you all go through and you're voting. So they would meet in there. Powell said, and this is an example of Wilson's mastery of all the political arts. Powell says to him, you know what, I'm gonna vote Labour. And I tell you what, I'm gonna tell my supporters to vote Labour. Wilson says, hang on, this is almost 6 months before the election, by the way, this is 73. Wilson says, let's have another meeting and talk this through. They meet five or six times. Wilson says to Powell, don't just waste it. Do it like this. On the Saturday, make a speech attacking Heath. On the Sunday in the Sunday papers, tell them that you've had your postal vote and you're voting Labour. And on the Monday, encourage all your supporters to vote Labour. Do it that way. Wilson cleared the decks for him so that there was nothing happening that would be equally as newsworthy. Labour won by such a slim majority. I mean, Wilson's greatest biographer is a man called Ben Pimlott, whose biography was published in 1992, the full fat version. Mine is a concise biography. And Pimlott makes light of this, you know, that actually might have had an effect. When you look at how close that election was, and you look how Powell was revered, particularly in the Midlands and with an awful lot of Conservatives across the country, you kind of think that could have just done it.
That's a proper political
This is why Wilson got a reputation for being slippery because of things like that. I don't call it being slippery. I call it being absolute, you know, the master of the political arts and also making sure that you get the best advantage for your party.
Before we go on to questions,
yeah.
Just sum up Wilson's achievements.
Oh, how long have we got? I mean, you know, this is a man whose achievement, even the ones that don't get the kind of... under Wilson, it was a free vote, but homosexuality was decriminalised. It was a 10-minute rule bill, actually. But these things don't happen. I know, I was in Parliament for 20 years, unless the Prime Minister wants them to happen. You don't get a private members' bill through unless the government want it to go through. We had a brilliant Home Secretary in Roy Jenkins who believed in this stuff, but Wilson had to go along with it as well. So the legalisation of homosexuality, or decriminalisation of homosexuality, legalised abortions to stop the backstreet butchers abortions were going on, but they certainly weren't, you know, they weren't carried out by proficient clinicians. That came in through a private members' bills. The first ever protection for ethnic minorities, the Race Relations Act, that you could not say to someone, I'm not employing you because you're black, or room to let, no Irish, no dogs, no blacks. I saw those windows growing up, not in Battersea, by the way, but in North Kensington, in Notting Hill. So the first ever protection on race relations, the first ever equalities legislation. Wilson believed in women. He believed at a time when it was very unfashionable for a man born in 1916, not just promoting people like Barbara Castle, but Shirley Williams, Judith Hart, Joan Lester. And he was very, very focused on equalities legislation. Then things that are not talked about. I mean, this is not the action of a populist. You remember how those who were around at the time, how popular the introduction of the breathalyzer was. I mean, that went down really well. And compulsory seatbelts, you know, and the abolition of capital punishment, which once again was on a free vote, but was facilitated by the Wilson government, and the end of censorship in the theatre. All of these things were crucial changes in our society. And whilst Jenkins gets the credit, and deservedly for lots of that, it was Wilson as Prime Minister that enabled Jenkins to do it. And if Wilson has said no, he's the first amongst equals, it wouldn't have happened.
So much more to talk about, but we shall go now to questions. Thank you, Alan, for that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You haven't mentioned Harold Wilson's relationship with the unions, which I always thought was a rather negative and took until Thatcher to rein back.
Yeah. No, I haven't, but it's very important. I mean, my book mentions Wilson's failures as well as his successes. He failed in relation to what was then called Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. He tried very hard to convince Ian Smith to have fair elections. There was elections by 300,000 white Southern Rhodesians, but leaving out 5 million blacks who didn't have the vote at all. Wilson tried and failed there. He tried and failed with the unions. The problem with the, I speak as a union man, and a union man in the 70s when Wilson was prime minister. The problem wasn't that the unions were too strong. The problem was the unions were too weak. They could not control their members. These wildcat strikes, i.e. not authorised by the union at all, not even authorised sometimes by the local branch committee, you know, never mind about union headquarters. You know, we cared about, we were against the minimum wage, by the way, then. I remember sitting in my tank top and flares at TUC voting against the minimum wage. The trade union movement in this country was against the minimum wage, but in favour of the closed shop, which was fundamentally undemocratic. Didn't join a union and got the sack. It was a bizarre situation for Britain's unions to be in. Wilson tried to rein that in. Barbara Castle was his great secretary, his great ally throughout his political life. He made her Secretary of State for Employment, brought in what was called In Place of Strife. And in the end, Wilson couldn't get it through. I mean, James Callaghan didn't help him either. He was his Home Secretary. He was made it clear he would vote against it. And he just couldn't get it through the Parliamentary Labour Party. And in the end, they did a fudge. Mr. Solomon Binding, the TUC gave a Solomon Binding assurance that they would control these unions, who often were walking out, by the way, because of inter-union disputes, nothing to do with the employer at all. We were a laughingstock. We were becoming a laughingstock. It had to be sorted out. Wilson realised that. He didn't sort it out on what came. Mrs. Thatcher did and went much further, by the way. I was a trade unionist in the 80s. It felt like she wanted a free democratic trade union movement in Poland. Not in Britain. You felt like an underground movement, this legislation that was so bitter. If the unions had backed Wilson, we might have had a very different trade union movement. And the trade union movement, which was anti-Europe as well, by the way, right into the 80s.
Might
have taken a different course.
History has been kind to Harold Wilson. Sorry, do you think history has been kind to Harold Wilson?
Will history be kind? It's not been kind so far. I mean, I'm starting the Harold Wilson Appreciation Society because, you know, for a man who, anyone who lived through the 60s, whatever your political persuasion, however you voted, you know, he was a dominant figure. He was as dominant politically in the 60s as the Beatles were in music, and incidentally, he had something to do with the Beatles as well. He's like one of those, you know, you watch a Hitchcock film, and there's a little cameo of Hitchcock pops up. Every great event from the 40s through to the 70s, Wilson's there somewhere. Nationalisation of coal, oh, there he is. Bevan's resignation, oh, he's in the forefront there.
Didn't he?
The Beatles,
give he gave the OBE.
He gave the Beatles their OBE.
Couple were thrown MBE. In the Thames afterwards.
All of that. And claimed, convinced the Showbiz Society that he should present them with their award, the Beatles, before they had a number one, on the spurious grounds that Ringo was a constituent of his. But, you know, he could see how things were going. So, but I think a combination of him, the way he went, we haven't talked about the Lavender List, and I don't think we've got time to, but that was a big scandal, and it was a big error of judgment by Wilson. With the peerages he created in his resignation list. But, you know, hell, you know, Boris Johnson gave a peerage to his hairdresser. Most people were surprised that he had a hairdresser, but, you know, to give him a peerage. But anyway, all of that meant that he went out at a time when the media were very keen to get their own back on him. He wasn't, I know it's okay now at Chalk Valley to talk about the Daily Mail, so I will. He once said, sitting on the terrace of the House of Commons to a guy he was having a drink with, if I was to jump over that wall down onto the Thames and walk across the Thames to St. Thomas's Hospital, the headline in the Daily Mail would be "Prime Minister Can't Swim." And, you know, he, the people who said he was a tricky customer and not to be trusted were the people he'd outsmarted, and he outsmarted a lot of people. Suddenly, he didn't have the defence of being Prime Minister anymore. And he also had this terrible dementia that was gripping that magnificent brain. And a combination of that, and then along came Thatcher, and then it seemed to be okay to sell off council houses and demutualize building societies and put people out of work. There was a different, suddenly Wilson seemed quite old-fashioned, you know, looking for a planned economy and all these kind of things that he kind of learned from Attlee, I suppose. A combination of all those things means he's virtually damaged without, he's vanished without trace. And even in the Labour Party, I talked to lots of Labour Party events about Wilson, you know, young Labour Party up and coming, they know about Attlee, they know about Blair, the government I was proud to serve in. They don't really know about Wilson and his huge achievements, probably more than any. And I'll just say this one other thing because I forgot to mention it. You know, what he did with the divorce laws, which he did very early with a majority of four, which is to introduce the concept of irretrievable breakdown, probably made added to the sum of human happiness to a degree, particularly for women trapped in marriages with violent husbands, because it was almost impossible to get a divorce unless you had a few bob and you could pay for it. That one change early in his time, you know, did an awful lot.
Question over here.
Thanks for the talk. I definitely appreciate Wilson a bit more. So you mentioned Wilson's effect upon the Conservative Party and how they elected their leaders for quite a time afterwards. How do you characterise his effect in the current Labour Party?
Masterly, the way he dealt with the Labour Party. And a good example of that is the European referendum. It was the 50th anniversary just 2 weeks ago, I think, in June 1975, you know, where he had, we were in the European Union, so he had the people like Jenkins who had voted to go, wanted to be in Europe, saying, why are you having a referendum on the European Union? You know, we're members. The deal is done, we're in. And then you had the people who wanted to come out, which was the vast majority of Labour and all the practically all the unions, apart from mine, strangely, post office workers were never in that camp. But they were saying, look, you've got a conference decision carried by 20-1 to say pull out. You've got the Parliamentary Labour Party, who are thought to be much more centrist and responsible, voting 10-1 to just pull out. Why are you having a referendum? Just come out. The referendum was the perfect solution. Actually proposed by Tony Benn in the days when he was more Lafayette than Robespierre. I mean, he went on that journey. It was Tony Benn that suggested it. And in the end, it was the perfect solution. 67% yes. Every region in Britain voted yes, apart from the Western Isles, strangely enough, and Shetland. It might have been something to do with oil. Everywhere else voted yes, 67% on average. Mrs. Thatcher was delighted. Everyone was delighted. And it brought the party together, but he took a lot of flack over that from both sides. So the way he managed the party was correct. Wilson always said, the Labour Party, running the Labour Party is like driving a stagecoach. You have to go very, very fast. And then the people inside the stagecoach are either too exhilarated or travel sick to argue. It's when you stop and get out and start talking about where we're going that all the troubles begin. So he was...
We've got time, I think, for one more.
Thank you. 12 years of a Conservative government, a decent majority in the 59 election, but you end up with a change in Prime Minister and scandals at the end. Doesn't sound dissimilar to what we've just been through, but the elections had different results. What do you think Wilson could have done if he'd had a majority like Starmer's?
I think the lesson that Wilson would have been saying to Starmer, incidentally, who says that Wilson is his most respected prime minister. I don't know how Tony thinks it feels about that, but there you go. would be get the unpopular stuff out of the way early. Now, maybe Starmer's doing that. But of course, Wilson was talking with the thing we haven't talked about, which is devaluation, which we haven't got time to go into. When Wilson came in 64, there were plenty of people who were arguing on the right of British politics, never mind on the left, that we needed to devalue. The pound was where it had been since Stafford Cripps had devalued, from $4.07 to the pound down to $2.80 to the pound. It was still too high. We couldn't export. People weren't buying our goods. We were sucking in cheap imports. And Wilson didn't, because he remembered that when Attlee devalued in 49, Stafford Cripps, the Chancellor, had gone on the Home Service and said, this will never happen again. Wilson took that very personally. And it wasn't until 67 in the end that he was forced to devalue. We were putting 15% tariffs on imports, another thing that, you know, Mr. Trump might have got the idea from, Harold, who knows. You know, we were using up our reserves. And in the end, he had to agree to devalue. And then the problem wasn't so much devaluing, it was the television interview he gave when he was too clever by half and changed the words. I'll just finish this. I know it's not answering your question, but I'm a politician and we generally don't. So it's centered around, I was confused about this at the time, but now I see very clearly. He was supposed to say, the Treasury brief, because Wilson insisted, unlike Stafford Cripps as Chancellor, he did the broadcast. Wilson insisted on doing it himself as Prime Minister. And the worry was, back in 49, they remembered that when people heard there was a devaluation, and then it was 30%, by the way, they thought, it wasn't decimal currency then, but they thought that every pound I've got in the bank is now going to be worth 70p. I better go and get my money out. So to stop that happening again, the Treasury brief said to him, he insisted on doing it, not Callaghan, the Chancellor, this doesn't mean the pound in your savings is worth less. Wilson, too clever by half, changed it. A bit of alliteration, the pound in your pocket or your purse. He said, this doesn't mean the pound in your pocket or your purse is being devalued. Instead of saying is worth less, he said is being devalued. Well, of course, it was being devalued. The pound was being devalued. And if you were going on a foreign holiday, as many people were then in the late 60s, you soon found out it wasn't worth as much when you got to Spain or whatever. But if he'd said is worth less, that would have given the meaning to try and stop people thinking their money in the bank was diminishing. Saying it wasn't being devalued meant he was pulled apart, particularly by Heath, his old pal, you know, saying that he'd actually misled the British people. And I can see why. It's over those three words. So if he'd have done it immediately, if he'd done it quickly in 64, there wouldn't have been the same fuss.
Thank you very much, Alan. Masterful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.